Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we'll be speaking with John Bauermaster. He's a filmmaker, an adventurer, and the author of the book Descending the Dragon, My Journey Down the Coast of Vietnam. I'd like to introduce Richard Camp. I'd like to introduce Richard Camp. He is the environmental liaison for WIC Newspapers, which is a national newspaper chain, 42 papers, and he's the director of the nonprofit eTech International. Welcome, Richard, to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
So, you are an environmental activist and you are a journalist. What's going on? How are you combining those two things?
Well, I try and keep them geographically separate so that the advocacy work, which is primarily technical support to developing countries on environmental issues, usually major ones involving toxics, that's eTech International, that's nonprofit, that's south of the border, north of the border, east or west of the border. It's been mostly south. And that doesn't make enough money to live on. I worked in the nonprofit world for about 20 years and gave up.
Wait, when you say south of the border, you mean in Latin America? eTech International is doing work, development work in Latin America. But when you say north and east and west of the border,
well, it could be Canada.
Ah, okay.
It really still isn't our country. It should be.
Say some people, yes. And meanwhile, you do environmental journalism here in the Southwest.
Well, it's been a mix. I've worked, the WIC newspapers hired me more or less on condition that I would help the individual newspapers as a reporter, sometimes an editor, sometimes a technical reader, very often doing investigative work, sometimes essentially as a gopher, you know, sometimes even a photographer. But that I would be their environmental person for the chain. The chain stretches from Louisiana, North Carolina, North Dakota, South Dakota, New Mexico, a couple of papers, Grants, Rio Rancho. These are all WIC newspapers. Nine papers in Arizona, California, Alaska, Oregon.
So do you focus on issues specific to those states primarily?
I focused mostly on Colorado, Southwest Colorado, Arizona, a little bit of California, North Carolina, and a tiny bit of New Mexico, and I probably will be increasing some of the work. I'm working on uranium mining and environmental and health aspects of it, which is a new area.
Which we hope to hear more about on the Radio Cafe.
Yeah.
One of the things that you've been focusing on is the Clean Water Act, which hails from 1972 and has recently been, I don't know if gutted would be too strong a word to say, but deeply affected by a Supreme Court decision a couple of years ago.
It appears to be actually gutted. The Supreme Court basically made a couple of decisions, one in 2001 in Illinois. That one took a long-standing policy that said wherever water might flow, the intent of Congress when they passed the 72 Clean Water Act amendments was to protect the United States from pollution. And this had been interpreted to mean that the 91 or 92% of New Mexico, the 96% of Arizona, that does not have perennial flow in its stream beds was protected through the Clean Water Act, through a part of it called Section 402.
So basically, and water flows part of the year, water doesn't flow part of the year because it's a desert, but wherever it does flow, whenever it does flow, under the 1972 Clean Water Act amendments, even states like ours are protected.
Well, it was that way.
It was.
And it was that way from court decisions in 1975 until it began to break down in 2001.
What happened then?
Well, in that decision, the Supreme Court decided that wetlands, if they weren't connected to a flowing body of water, they were no longer going to be protected. And that meant either by the Army Corps of Engineers that was supposed to be blocking people who would otherwise block the flow, which is often where wetlands end up being regulated, is through the Army Corps, or through the EPA or state agencies that were implementing the act, who would be, you know, protecting an area from pollution. But it was in 2006, not very long ago, in June and July of 2006, a decision called the Rapinos decision, which was a challenge posed by some people in Michigan, again, regarding the Army Corps of Engineers and wetlands. But they decided to challenge, right up to the Supreme Court, the state of Michigan, who said, look, you can't block this area off, you're drying off this wetlands. And essentially the Supreme Court came up with a very bizarre decision.
So just to help people understand, the case was about somebody wanted to block off wetlands, which would basically destroy the wetlands, and the state of Michigan was protecting them?
Yes.
Using the Clean Water Act?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And, you know, the short of this decision was that you had what's called a plurality. You had the four libs, or mainstream supremes, coming out and saying that, hey, you know, Congress...
Mainstream supremes,
the
meaning...
The mainstream supremes are...
On the Supreme... Okay.
They're an R&B group that got on the Supreme Court.
That got on the Supreme Court. Yes.
Versus the right-wing supremes, who are also an R&B group that got on the Supreme Court. But they basically, you know, they split. You had, you know, the four more liberal members deciding that they would take the traditional interpretation of the Clean Water Act, which is that, hey, if water is going to flow in here anytime, any place, you know, we protect it. We protect it by keeping it from being obstructed and blocked, you know, by a development, by a farmer, by anybody.
And you protect it from pollution.
And you protect it from pollution. The pollution, which is largely Section 402 of the Act, is, you know, is going to be the EPA or any state that's got the authority. So they split. The other, you know, four within this nine said, no way, you know, if the water's not flowing, you know, the Clean Water Act doesn't apply. And then Justice Anthony Kennedy...
What does that mean, not flowing? There's like a puddle, a swamp? I mean, what do we mean by water not flowing?
Well, we mean really any conduit for the movement of water that can carry pollution, or where the movement of water would end up in, and there was this word in the 1972 Act, a navigable body of water. Nobody knew what the hell that meant. I mean, it had been...
Navigable by canoes...
Canoes, kayaks...
Ocean liners, paper boats.
Inner tubes, ocean liners, paper boats. I think you've got the crux of the issue, you know, well-defined. It was a definition made in hell. And when they came to this decision in 2006, you know, you had Justice Anthony Kennedy saying, well, as long as there's a significant nexus to, you know, to a navigable body of water, then the Clean Water Act should apply. Well, did he mean Section 404 of the Clean Water Act and the Army Corps of Engineers? Did he mean pollution, protection from pollution in Section 402? And what is a significant nexus to a body of water?
So that's the kind of, it sounds like language that was attempting at a compromise in a split court, but it was in terms of actual implementation, sounds like it was tricky.
If it had been Bill Clinton implementing it and not George Bush, it may have been interpreted quite differently. But it wasn't.
And who does implementing when a Supreme Court decision like that happens?
Well, a regulatory agency. You know, if the Supreme Court makes a decision, it can be about anything. It can be about, you know, women, schools.
Right, but in a case like this, where wetlands
like this,
are concerned.
It's, you know, it's basically where there's obstruction involved, or development. All permits are given by the Army Corps of Engineers. And this has been the case. There are no state authorities, even though there's lesser state authorities. If it's pollution, there it gets really tricky, because it depends whether or not a state has set up, you know, has created its own laws that are strong enough that they actually trump the federal authority of the Clean Water Act. So a state may have designed a law. That law may have been approved by the federal government, and that may not be the Clean Water Act. California is an example of that. So after that, it's up to the state. If you're in the north part of California, by God, you know, Rapinos is going to be, you know, They're going to be holding up their arms and saying, wait, you know, our state is going to protect, you know, protect from pollution. If you're in the south of the state, that's not necessarily the case.
Rapinos being the name of the Supreme Court decision in 2006
that we're talking about. The Rapinos decision is
often
called just Rapinos. It's become a noun, a verb, and an adverb.
Okay.
So in the case of, you know, other states, Arizona, New Mexico, for example, or Nevada, then it depends on the will of the state, but it's at the mercy of the courts. And because it's under the Clean Water Act, neither New Mexico nor Arizona nor Nevada decided that they wanted a law any stronger than the federal law. So they implement the Clean Water Act. Now, Arizona has taken a very strong position saying, you know, one, we have to reform this act. We have to do something about it. The governor and the environmental agencies have been testifying and demanding change of Congress.
So basically you have a state saying after a Supreme Court decision, we are now amending a federal act?
No, you have the state claiming that they have some authorities to regulate pollution and they're going to take it to the max, but that this is a crisis. We have Region 9 EPA, which does represent the federal government, but still remains kind of a liberal arm of the federal government, saying, you know, this is a mess. This is a total mess.
So, explain this to us. I'm even getting lost here, and I've read the articles.
Well, let's make it really simple.
What's the mess?
The mess is that the Clean Water Act has, in its two arms, stopped being enforced to a large extent.
Because of this
Rapinos
2006 decision.
What that's meant is that, you know, if you go out right here in this parking lot and you take some toxic waste and you dump it in the parking lot outside the Santa Fe Baking Company, state of New Mexico might want to prosecute you. But if you're trying to make a test case, you're going to take it to court. You're going to say, hey, this is not a navigable body of water. The state does not regulate surface waters. There is no water. I can do anything I damn well please.
And so before that, if you dumped toxic waste anywhere that eventually made its way into water, you were liable under the Clean Water Act.
You could be arrested. You would be.
So in real life, since nobody we know is actually dumping kerosene into the parking lot here, what is actually happening that is toxic?
Mines, sewers, sewage systems, particularly private ones, industrial discharges, they're all challenging in court. Not all of them, but a substantial number of them.
Are
challenging
the
rights of the government, to regulate them. They'll say, look, this is our plan, this is our perm, this is what we're going to do. You can't do anything more to us. You can't regulate us. But more to the point, the Bush administration testified before Congress in April of this year. And they testified at a hearing being held by Congressman Oberstar of Minnesota, who along Russ Feingold in the Senate has introduced legislation. There's legislation in both houses. At this point, it has support of about 40% of both houses. And it's an attempt to say, hey, the Clean Water Act intent of Congress in 1972 was to protect water. So this is the language we're going to try and apply, you know, in order to cope with the indeterminate decision made by the Supreme Court. Now, what came out in July of 2008 when Greenpeace stole a memo or was given a memo by an EPA employee and gave it to Congressman Henry Waxman, who released it and has been trying to hold a hearing on this, was that EPA's enforcement chief, a man named Benjamin Nyakama in Washington, issued a memo to the head of the EPA. And he said, hey, enforcement is frozen. And approximately overall, 70% of the cases, we're not enforcing the law anymore because of Rapinos. When we have a decision come before us, an existing one, even one that started before it, we're not doing a thing.
So EPA said, we're not enforcing the Clean Water Act anymore because of this.
This was an internal memo, and this was very shortly after the Bush administration had testified before Congress in April that there was no problem, that the law was being enforced. Now, this is just the EPA side.
Government lied?
No, government didn't lie. They just didn't tell the truth.
All right. We're talking to Richard Camp. Go ahead.
So you basically, you know, following this, there is an issue that I've been dealing with that Waxman brought up, and he has one of his own. And that's that in Arizona, I've been covering the fact that the Santa Cruz River was declared navigable by a local head of the Army Corps of Engineer, and various people intervened politically. Now, navigable, remember, was the word that was part of this decision. And this woman, the regional, she's not the regional director, but basically the person who's coordinating, you know, a good chunk of California and a good chunk of Arizona, determined that there had been historical flows within the Santa Cruz River in southeast Arizona that were enough that that sections of it were navigable and therefore should be protected by the Army Corps of Engineers from being obstructed, which could in turn be determined to say that the EPA could also enforce the law. However, within about 2 or 3 weeks after this, under political pressure from an attorney from Washington, the Army Corps of Engineers decided that the decision was now on hold. And various congressional representatives went ballistic, saying, wait a minute, you know, two things are happening here. You're deciding that the Santa Cruz River isn't navigable. The EPA has lied about the fact that they're not enforcing the law. Waxman has the Los Angeles River, which is pretty much in the same position. Large parts of it are considered to not be navigable, therefore not to be protected by the Clean Water Act from either pollution or from being obstructed in a, you know, incredibly dense area. And so we've been coming to a head up until the economic crisis trumped Rapinos, where Waxman first demanded all the documentation from the EPA of the court cases, and they refused. He then subpoenaed the head of the EPA, and he subpoenaed, you know, a number of staffers, and he also subpoenaed the assistant administrator who wrote the memo, and they also refused to respond. And so he had a hearing that was scheduled that's been put off because of the crash in the stock market. But the short of this is that, you know, I wrote one story. I mean, I stumbled on this because I was covering and have been covering a lot what we call the mining rebellion in southern Arizona, where there's been an attempt to not allow new mining. Well, this suddenly became an issue when the state was proposing to pass regulations that would establish very high water quality standards that no mine could meet. And suddenly it turned out that everybody from the mining and also the Pima County government, and Pima County government is quite liberal and environmental.
And that's in Arizona.
This is in southeast Arizona, where the Santa Cruz River is and where various flows to it go. They were basically testifying that, hey, you know, you can't enforce the law right now because of the Rapinos decision. I thought, what in the hell is the Rapinos decision? And that's where this started and quickly accelerated. You know.
So, and this is something, I mean, probably not a lot of our listeners know about it and know that this Clean Water Act is essentially gutted and not being enforced, and that there are all these people chomping at the bit to build, pollute, obstruct waterways under the Supreme Court
Correct.
Decision. That's basically the bottom line.
That's the bottom line.
In the West, in the East, everywhere in the country?
And the other, in the West, in the East, less so because there are more areas. There's been hundreds of court decisions, hundreds and hundreds since 2006. And there's, you know, thousands more in the wings. And in the East, you have more places where the flow of water is obvious. But in the West, you know,
Because we're desert, this word navigable
yes.
becomes operative in the East.
Navigable
the
means 4% of Arizona, 8% of New Mexico, 11% of Colorado,
right.
You know, 6% or 5% of Nevada or 3%, I don't remember the figures. And not much of California.
Of the bodies of water.
Of the bodies of water do not flow.
Yeah.
And so what is navigable and why do we have to deal with this damn definition anyway? And it's the solution to this is to get a bill through Congress.
So there is
and there
a
is
bill.
The bill is the Oberstar-Feingold bill. It's worth contacting, you know, your senator, your congressman, and I contacted Obama's office and, you know, got a long statement from Obama saying that he would put this high in his environmental priorities.
What about McCain?
McCain had an interesting talk with his press man, who said, yeah, this is a problem, but we don't want intrusive federal language. And I said, yeah, but let's get to the point. is this a problem or not? And he said, yeah. And I said, well, are we on the record or off the record? Well, we're off the record. Well, then what should we do? And I said, you're asking me what should we do. I think the answer is obvious. You come up with language for this bill which will satisfy people who do worry about federal intrusions. For example, Congresswoman Gifford, who I think is very intelligent.
Wait a minute, you're sitting here telling the McCain press officer what to do?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
I said I'm not going to answer that question.
Right.
But I mean, what to do is obvious. No, so I didn't tell the press office.
So
but in the end, I got no quote at all from McCain's office.
So they basically have no position on it.
They punted, yes.
They punted. Okay. So we have a bill before Congress that would basically restore the Clean Water Act to what it was in the first place in 1972 and essentially override the Supreme Court decision of 2006. Would that be putting it correctly?
No, it would reinterpret what Congress intended, which is what you can do as Congress. You can't override a Supreme Court decision, but a Supreme Court decision is a court decision on the laws. Congress writes the laws.
Right, but in other
words, what they can do is they can clarify the language, they can remove the language, they can, you know, clarify their intent of the law, thereby addressing...
But in essence, what would this law before Congress actually accomplish?
It would actually restore the authority to where it was for 30 years,
okay.
Or nearly 30 years.
So basically, it would restore the Clean Water Act.
That's the idea.
So what is to be done by our listeners who might be interested in this whole question?
Well, there's two things you can do. I would say the very first thing is keep it simple. Write, call, email your senator, your congressman, man, or your future senator, and tell them that you want to see the Oberstar-Feingold bill to pass. You want them to be working on any language that needs to be clarified to get widespread support, and you want to see this signed into law by the president, you know, economic crash and all, in early 2009.
So that is where we're at, and we're just about out of time, but we would like to follow up on this, and we would like to follow up on what ETEC International does, which is the other part of your work that is doing very interesting projects, but we will do it next time we get together.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Richard Camp is the environmental liaison for WIC Newspapers and the director of the nonprofit ETEC International.
And one final suggestion.
Yes.
If you're interested in ETEC International, before we do talk about it, we have a very clear website, which will tell you what we're doing in Latin America and on alternative energy and on different areas, providing technical support to nations that are really struggling because they don't get that on environmental issues. And that is www.etechinternational, one word.
The letter E-T-E-C-H.
E-T-E-C-H International.
And, .com.
Yeah, .org. We're a nonprofit.
Right.
That's why I'm a reporter.
That's what I meant. Richard Camp, thanks so much for being with us. We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. Right now, I would like to welcome John Bauermaster. He is a kayaker, filmmaker, and author of the book Descending the Dragon, My Journey Down the Coast of Vietnam. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And so you have just been in Taos this past weekend showing your film at the Taos Film Festival. This was a film you decided to do something that I think nobody has ever thought of, namely sea kayaking down the coast of Vietnam.
Well, my passion is for investigating the lives of people who live and depend on the sea. And when we mounted this big 10-year-long project where the intention was to kayak around the world one continent at a time. And when I looked at the map of Asia, for whatever reason or reasons, Vietnam jumped out at me. And so, yeah, we started negotiating with the government in Hanoi to bring kayaks to Vietnam and kayak 800 miles down the coastline from the border of China down to Hoi An. And, you know, my initial reasoning proved correct. We met hundreds, thousands of people every day. So we brought back lots and lots and lots of stories.
And some of those stories are in the book, some of them are in the movie. And you made this film for National Geographic. I mean, what was the idea of the film before you started it? And then how did that evolve as you actually started doing it and met people?
Well, as an American, I just felt like North Vietnam was a part of the world that, despite the fact that fighting had been over there, what, of course, the Vietnamese called the American War, had been over for 30 years, it was still a place that we as Americans didn't know very well, didn't understand, certainly not the north of Vietnam. So I wanted to go back and meet the people so that I could personally kind of replace the images of Vietnam that I had. I'd never been there before, which had come mostly from movies. You know, my images of Vietnam were mostly from Apocalypse Now and Deer Hunter and Platoon and things like that, but those are false images. Those are antique at this stage. So I wanted to replace those, both for myself, and then, of course, because I took a photographer and a videographer, we were able to bring back great visuals to try and change the impressions that our readers and our viewers had as well.
So obviously the impressions that you have from movies like this were from the American soldier point of view, but you got to see the Vietnamese point of view talking about the American war. What did you find that the range of people's attitudes were toward Americans and toward this part of their history?
Well, we traveled for a couple months by kayak, and I really don't think we suffered one word of animosity, even though we were mostly Americans. One interesting thing I did was I knew I needed someone to travel with me who spoke the language, because obviously my Vietnamese is very poor, in fact non-existent. So I found a woman whose family had fled Vietnam on the last day of fighting in 1975. She, with her family, had come to the United States. She'd grown up in New Orleans. They continued to speak the language in the house. She'd been back to Vietnam several times. She wasn't a very experienced kayaker. In fact, she wasn't experienced at all. But she was so good on the other sides that I brought her along with us. And the fact that she was from the South and that we were traveling mostly in the North then became part of our adventure, part of our experience.
She's an interesting character. She was a self-described Vietnamese-American princess.
Yeah, a VAP.
A VAP.
Yeah. Of which apparently there are many. I mean, there are more resettled Vietnamese refugees in the United States than any other nationality, largely because I think the United States felt very guilty after the end of fighting and let a lot of refugees in.
And so there you were, this little crew of five people in what, five separate kayaks?
Did you
have two-man kayaks?
No, we had three singles and one double.
And with cameras and gear and all this stuff, and presumably they hadn't seen a whole lot of kayaks.
No, they'd very rarely seen kayaks, but I will say, and this is true of all of our explorations of coastlines around the world, is when we arrive at these very remote places by boat, people are very accepting. These are people who spend most of their days in boats. They live on the edge of the sea. They assume everyone spends their time in boats. So they never once asked us, really, why are you here? They were very curious about why the boats were bright colors, what they were made of. They loved our bailing pumps because, of course, most of their boats leaked very badly.
Right.
We traded many, many pumps for rice wine. But the beauty of the kayaks was they really gave us access to parts of Vietnam that we would never have reached otherwise because we were arriving from the sea.
So there was no particular mission. It was just like, let's meet people, all kinds of people, all classes, all walks of life.
Yep, let's bring back a story of what Vietnam, particularly what we regard as North Vietnam, is like today, because I really felt that was kind of an unknown. When I first went to Vietnam in 2000, I think there were about 700,000 tourists a year coming to Vietnam. Now, today, in 2008, 4 million. So it's become a boom industry.
And who are these tourists? Or where do they come from? What are they doing there?
Well, you know, a lot of Americans, a lot of Europeans, and I was there just 1 year ago this month, and you're seeing a lot of middle-class Chinese because it's very close and they have disposable income.
Right, right. And so what do tourists do when they go to Vietnam?
Well, the tricky part is, you know, I encourage people to go because it helps support the economy of Vietnam. It's a pretty poor country, but it's also a very small country, and it's also a communist country. So they do try and monitor where tourists go. And as a result, all of these now 4 million tourists a year are basically following and trotting in the same paths. So you know what happens on land when people follow the same paths. You get a kind of a rutted trail. And now the same thing is happening along the coastline because there are places, especially in Ha Long Bay in the north, which is very beautiful. There's 350 beautiful limestone islands rising straight out of the sea. That's what everyone wants to go and visit. But of course, the boats that are carrying them now are all going, it's like a shuttle back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And you can imagine the kind of trail of pollution, plastic bags, candy wrappers, fuel spills, etc.
Well, it's like probably many of the national parks here. The last time I went to the south rim of the Grand Canyon, it was like a tourist processing plant.
Yeah, no, it's not pretty. It's one of those places that I'm actually glad I saw previously, even though it was only 8 years ago, so things are changing very fast.
Very interesting.
But it's a dynamic country. I mean, you go to Hanoi, which is the capital of the country, which is where the seat of the communist government, and you feel like you're in a booming democracy. I mean, I've been there many times. I'm not convinced I've met a communist.
What is Hanoi like? Give us the feeling of that city.
Actually, I've traveled a bit around the world, and Hanoi is one of my favorite, if not my favorite, big cities. It was still, it's avoided that kind of tall glass skyscraper that dominates so many of the South Asian cities. It's all this kind of crumbling French architecture. There's only a couple, maybe one tall skyscraper within the city limits. So,
well, you talked in the book about how your favorite cities are cities planned by the French.
Yeah, Hanoi, obviously, Paris, and then Washington, D.C., largely because they're all based on circles and roundabouts. They're built around a hub, kind of. And the other thing that all three of those cities have in common is in Washington, D.C., nothing can be built taller than the Capitol. In Paris, nothing can be built taller than the Sacré-Cœur. And in Hanoi, nothing can be built taller than Ho Chi Minh's mausoleum. So you have this incredible big open sky, similar to here in Santa Fe, that you see all the time in all those cities, which I think is great.
We're talking to John Bauermaster. His book is called Descending the Dragon, My Journey Down the Coast of Vietnam, with photography by Rob Howard, who's a marvelous photographer.
Yeah, I specifically took Rob on this trip because of his portraiture work. He's a great, great portrait photographer. And we also agreed that he would take primarily black and white photos of the people we met. And he carried a big Polaroid camera. The pictures that are in the book are primarily Polaroids.
Is that right?
Which meant that he
I didn't know they still had those.
Yeah, which meant that he was exposing them and then developed them, processing them as we moved along, which has brought a whole new element of work to his days. And one of my reasons for pushing to publish these books is that I travel with really great photographers, and I hate that so often we come back from these trips and so many of their beautiful images just end up in a desk drawer and no one sees them.
So you say there's no real, you didn't meet any real communists. What is the stamp of communism? How do you see it, if you do, when you travel in Vietnam?
Well, I arrived as a journalist, so any journalist who comes to Vietnam needs the approval of the Foreign Press Center. And no matter if you're working for the Hoboken News or the Food Channel or the National Geographic, as I do, you must agree to be followed, accompanied by a government-supplied monitor 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, which is true in our case as well. And that person that they assigned to us became part of our adventure. His name was Lin. He was perfect for our trip because he was not a big fan of water. I'm not convinced he could swim.
You had him in a kayak?
Well, his goal was to follow us, so he would hire small boats or big boats or monitor us from land if he could through binoculars. And I would say to him on many, many occasions, or I would ask him, why do you feel a need to accompany us, follow us? And he would say, well, I'm here only to make sure you meet people who tell the truth.
And, the truth police.
Yeah, and I would say, I would follow up and ask, well, how do you identify them? How can you tell? And what we assessed was, you know, they're in a country of 85 million people, 75 million are Buddhist, 10 million are Catholic. And they seemed, the government and their emissary Lin, seemed to be most concerned whenever we would arrive by kayak in a small Catholic community, which we wouldn't really know in advance until we kind of rounded a curve or pulled up on the beach and saw a church steeple with a cross on it, and then we would know we were in a Catholic town.
And so they were suspicious of Catholics?
Very, very, yeah.
Why, because they could lie and then confess on Sunday?
No, they believed that the Catholic Church, which is pretty well organized, is one place that could foment protest if there were to be a protest. And we talked to many, many people kind of in hidden corners in a way, because they really did kind of follow us when we were interviewing people. And they would, if we were arriving in a Catholic community, for example, Lynn would have called ahead to alert the local party officials so that they would turn out as well to greet us, so that anyone we met was now just not just meeting us, but they were meeting us accompanied by a phalanx of local party people. So they're very intimidated. And in the end, because we did have some conversations with them outside of the earshot of the monitors, you know, what they had to complain about were basically the same things people around the world complain about. They want better jobs and better pay. They want better education for their kids. They want better health care. You know, there was no one we met who was plotting to overthrow the government in Hanoi.
So the main way that you encountered communism was through the government telling you what you couldn't do. I love this term that kept on coming up, which was you can't go to certain places because of military sensitivities, which is the ultimate oxymoron.
Right, and we were there just on the heels of a visit by Bill and Hillary Clinton in the waning days of Clinton's presidency. And they'd had some very severe flooding in that springtime, and so President Clinton had brought along satellite images taken by a U.S. satellite that showed the entire coastline of Vietnam, and he presented this to the Vietnamese government because they didn't have them. And of course, in those satellite imagery was every military base, every little outpost that the government had. So for them, for the government of Vietnam to suggest that we might expose military secrets was silly. From our kayaks, what are we going to do with one still camera and a video camera?
But in terms of the populace, in terms of the regular people, was there a sense that either communist ideology, way of life, economics had made them who they are?
Absolutely. I mean, it's not a place that knows freedom of speech or freedom of press. Not at all. And they allow freedom of religion only in that they do allow the Catholics to exist there, which is a hangover from the French days, when the French were there in the 50s and 40s and 30s. But the way we sought evidence was that people would tell us that if you're in a room with five Vietnamese people, guaranteed one of them is a government informant. Guaranteed. Now, whether that's true or not, it's hard to tell, but that's what they believe. So that everyone's very cautious of what they say.
Right.
And so as a result, because we're storytellers, we've got big cameras, we're asking them to tell us truths, you know, it starts to shape the questions we ask. We had a very...
In what way? Explain more about
that.
Well,
we had a very open conversation, for example, with three men in their 40s who were fishermen, but pretty prosperous fishermen. We just crossed the border of what would have been South Vietnam if the border still existed. And they told us the story of kind of a new booming economy in Vietnam, which was the marrying off of sisters, aunts, nieces to outsiders, you know, from Australia, Europe, United States, in which Vietnamese families would pay $20,000, $25,000, $30,000 for one of these outside men to come in, marry one of their nieces, daughters, sisters,
females.
Take them back to their country, and then, you know, agree to a divorce, you know, 6 months or a year later or something. And they told us this story very openly.
Wait, who was paying who? Who was making money?
The families in Vietnam were paying the outsiders to come in.
And what did they get out of it?
$25,000. So I'm a white American man. I come to Vietnam.
So the American is paying.
No. The Vietnam family is paying me $25,000 to marry their sister and take her back to the U.S.
And then get divorced. I don't understand. What's the?
Well, she gets to live in. She gets to stay in the United States
for 6 months.
No. Then she's there.
Oh, I see. It's basically buying her citizenship or green card elsewhere.
I've gotten her out of the country for $25,000.
Right. Where do they come up with that kind of money?
Well, the extended families. The end of that story was though that they then said to us after being interviewed on the video cameras, that they said, well, of course, if you use that story in your film, if you tell that story, we'll go to jail. You'll never know it. You'll be gone. We'll never see you again. We'll be in jail, and you won't know.
So did you tell it in the documentary?
No, we didn't. Absolutely
but you're
not.
Telling it here. We hope that the Vietnamese security service isn't listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
No pictures or attached to it. But the reality was that I'm not sure that they really would have ended up in jail or not, but that's that level of intimidation that comes with a society that doesn't believe in freedom of speech.
So there's a tourist industry, and there's a very big fishing industry. What's that like?
Well, you know, 25 million of those 85 million people depend on fishing as their livelihood. So as we worked our way down the coast, almost every stop we would hang out with fishermen. And very kind of rudimentary, the men go out in big wooden boats two or sometimes three times a day. and then the women wait on shore and are basically the business managers. As soon as the men come back, they offload the hand the fish over to their wives, spouses, mothers, etc., and then the women do the weighing, the selling, the distribution of the fish. They believe that having a woman on the fishing boat is very superstitious, very bad luck. So the women, there are no women fishermen, except in instances where mom and pop might go out and do the fishing,
right.
But on the bigger boats, there are no women on the boats.
So are they dealing with the same problems that everybody else is, namely pollution and depletion of their fish stocks?
The depletion of the fish stocks, not so bad yet. The South China Sea seems to be pretty hardy. Of course, they're getting big pressure from the Chinese, and the Chinese are the first to remind the Vietnamese that it's called the South China Sea, not the South Vietnamese Sea. So they're trying to come in and grab everything they can, both on the fishing level, but also in oil and other minerals, which are in the seabed. But no, the biggest problem is pollution. I mean, we pulled into one bay in Ha Long Bay called Cat Ba, where there were 5,000 people living on boats in one harbor, basically. That's a lot of people sharing a pretty small body of water. And you can imagine the pollution resulting from lack of sanitation, fuel spills, etc. in that bay. Some guy, very sweet guy, I paddled up to the back of his boat, and he thought he was doing me a favor because he went to pick the bow of my kayak up onto his boat, which of course then spilled me into this bay, and they were in a panic because they never go in that water, and they immediately insisted I get out and jump in a barrel of rainwater to get whatever this was in the water off of me.
Did you have any scungy yuckers on you after that was done?
I survived. No, we've had pretty good luck. We've been traveling around the world on different waterways for a decade, and fingers crossed, no scungies.
We're talking to John Bauermaster. So you met so many people. Who are some of the most memorable people you met, and tell us their stories?
Well, you know, one of the themes that I had not anticipated was this theme of escape. Virtually everyone we met had a story of trying to escape or having a member of their family escape. I knew that we would hear those stories in the South, because at the end of fighting in 1975, many of the Southerners tried to escape because they knew that, you know, their retribution and re-education camps were going to come. But what amazed us was that in the North, virtually everyone had tried to escape as well, because after the war, the Americans put a very stiff embargo on the country and really drove it deep into poverty. So even though they were the vanquishers, even though they'd won, everybody wanted out. And so as we paddled along the coast, we would, in certain areas, especially where there was a little barrier island or something, we would paddle up and we would meet the poorest of crab fishing families. You know, extended families of 15 living basically in a little stilted shack. No money, not enough money to send their kids to school, anything like that. And right next door would be a, you know, by comparison, a beautiful home with tile floor and ceiling fans and electricity and boom boxes. And it was because that family had someone from it successfully escape. They'd get out to Hainan Island and over to Hong Kong and then off to Australia, Europe, Canada, United States. Once they'd done that, they were able to get a job working at Kinko's, working for landscape architecture, whatever their jobs, and send money back. And that is another boom economy on top of tourism that is supporting Vietnam now, is all this money coming back from outside into Vietnam.
It's such a funny thing. People doing jobs that when Americans do them, they're in debt, and when people from other countries do them, they're actually supporting not only themselves but other families.
Yeah, no, it was interesting every day. And even though it sounds cliche, I mean, we really were meeting people, especially on the islands off the coast, who had never met a Westerner, never seen an American. If they had seen an American, probably was a soldier in a uniform with a big gun. And that's why we traveled in a kind of a softer way. We were a team of five, three men and two women. And I included women as part of the team purposefully so that we would present ourselves as a softer image than they might have had.
Softer, gentler, and not be five American burly white guys showing up on shore and
exactly.
Bringing back flashbacks.
Exactly.
You said at the beginning of the book that you wanted to see how, sort of open yourself and see how Vietnam would change you. Looking back, how do you feel that it did, if it did?
Well, one thing was that we here in the States come from a pretty privileged place. You know, we have the luxury of wealth relative to the rest of the world, which gives us this kind of weird opportunity to constantly be looking back at history and kind of trying to reassess history, and particularly in this case, the Vietnam War. I mean, still today you'll hear people debating the rights and wrongs of a war that's now been over for 33 years. In Vietnam, we met none of that. I mean, they almost never brought up the subject of war, and it's largely because they're very poor, you know, and they're looking towards tomorrow and the future. They don't have that luxury of being able to sit in naval gaze and look backwards. And
although I have to say, I mean, there's other poor people around the world who are looking back, and, you know, the person across the river 500 years ago did something to us, and they're still remembering it.
Yeah, maybe ancestrally, but not culturally, and not based on current events. And I actually kind of admired that. The other part was that in of course, since with anyone who travels, I mean, you're constantly amazed and surprised at how open people are. I mean, everyone invited us into their homes. And one of the things that we saw in every home, whether it was Buddhist or Catholic, were their family altars. In Vietnam, like many Asian cultures, they celebrate not people's birthdays, but people's death anniversaries. So they keep these altars in remembrance of the relatives of theirs who have passed. It's a very prominent place in a person's home. They're very open to sharing it, but if they do share it with you, it's a very, very powerful thing. And I liked that kind of sense of family that we met, which, you know, again, in the States, you don't see as often.
So now you're back, and you're going around the country showing the film?
Well, we're showing the film. We have this beautiful new book out, published by National Geographic. And also, you know, it's the end of this 10-year-long project, this Oceans 8 project, that has taken us around the world one continent at a time.
It's the end of it? Yep. You've run out of continents?
We've run out of continents, yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Well, that's where the Oceans 8 comes from, 7 continents plus right. Oceania. So 8 different expeditions using sea kayaks as these kind of ambassadors to get us to places we couldn't get otherwise, to introduce us to people from kind of a peer level, a sea level. And it worked. You know, we really, I think we have this now this unique look at both the health of the world seas and what it's like for people who live and depend on the sea around the world.
So what's next for you?
Well, you know, we're going to continue the same storytelling, same subject matter. I don't think we'll be taking kayaks so much. But these stories of relationship between man and the sea. Since we've returned from Antarctica, we're editing that film, but we've already gone and shot new films in the Galapagos and also in southern Louisiana. And if you've been to southern Louisiana, you know that everyone who lives there has an integral relationship with water because it's everywhere. Swamps, bayous, rivers, creeks, the Mississippi, the Gulf of Mexico. So it was a fascinating subject matter for us, largely because people don't live there as neighbors. They don't live there for leisure reasons. They live there because they depend on these waterways. So it was perfect for us.
Well, we look forward to having you on the air if you come through Santa Fe again and talking about your next project. John Bauermaster is the author of Descending the Dragon, My Journey Down the Coast of Vietnam, and he just showed his film. Was it of the same name?
Yep, Descending the Dragon.
At the Taos Film Festival. So we want to thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Yeah, thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me by email at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want to listen to it, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Experience. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.